Welcome to Decaf and Debunk, a podcast all about busting myths and bringing light to popular and sometimes confusing topics in nutrition and health, because we all could use a little less caffeine and a little more science. I'm your host, Jesse.
And Hope.
And today we're talking about one of my favorite topics, and we're going to dive all into the world of poop, gut health, IBS, all of the questions, but probably start with poop and mainly focus on poop because we seem to kind of tangent into that in previous episodes. And so I think it grabs a lot of attention because there's a lot of stigma around talking about poop and bowel habits and just gut health in general, because as women, we're not supposed to poop. And so I feel like we avoid talking about it.
I don't poop. Kidding.
No bowel habits at all happen for any women ever. It's not ladylike.
And if it does, it smells like roses, obviously.
Duh.
We did want to start by giving a little bit of a shout out to a couple of our students who came up to us and told us about how they were watching us and their kitchen table during breakfast. And we got to meet a couple of parents that have been secondhand subjected to our shenanigans on here. So shout out to those students that have been listening. We really
know who you are.
Yeah. So because I'm not in the gut health realm, and so I really only just know about my personal experience, can you start by telling us a little bit about what poop consistency or frequency should kind of be like for someone? Because the general population might experience it differently. Like if you're making a general recommendation compared to what I know like to be true for me.
Yeah, poop is, so overall gut health is a really tricky topic to talk about because it's not really defined or like standardized, but our bowel habits and what our poop looks like and the consistency of it does tell us a lot of insight about what's going on in our gut and is a good proxy for our overall gut health. And so we'll talk about kind of the realm of gut health from a poop lens today, I guess. But in terms of just poop and consistency and frequency and all of the kind of just standard questions that I end up getting. So we have something that's called, I highly recommend that you look it up. If you Google it, it's very easy to find. It's called the Bristol Stool Scale. And so basically it is type 1 through type 7, and basically is just a layout of what your poop consistency can be, varying from type 1 being just very firm, dry, constipation, pebble-like, really hard to pass, basically has no moisture in it or very little moisture, all the way to type 7, which is basically it's just liquid, straight liquid. And so from type 1 to type 7, usually when we hit around the type 3, 4, and 5 mark is where we look towards having those more quote-unquote like normal bowel movements. So type 3, leaning a little bit more constipated, so maybe it's just not fully sticking together. Maybe it could use a little bit more moisture. To type 4, which is what we call kind of our unicorn poops. Those are just like very easy to pass, have basically a good amount of moisture in them. You're not having to strain or really put any effort into having those come out, and they stay relatively formed once they are in the toilet. And then type 5, you start to get a little looser. So maybe it's pretty easy to pass. It's moving through really quickly, but maybe it just doesn't hold up. Ends up getting to like that little kind of like soft serve poop emoji like consistency in the toilet. And so the goal is to be kind of in that range of a 3, 4, and 5. And so what I usually recommend for a lot of people is to just keep track of what's normal for you. Maybe you're just a solid 3 and everything's just going to be a little bit not quite as unicorn perfect. And that can be fine. There's definitely things we can do to help with that. But the biggest thing, and this is going to all of gut health and all of kind of poop, is knowing what your normal is and keeping tabs on, am I seeing changes from that? Because then that's where we start to think of red flags and should I go talk to someone and see what's going on here?
So if you have someone 3, 4, 5, but their normal has always been straining, or like what would probably be more like a one or a two, can that be someone's normal? Or is that like moving into, okay, there's probably something going on territory?
I would lean more probably something going on territory, more of usually from like the dietary diet perspective. But I mean, that could be someone's quote unquote normal because they just have not addressed what's causing that. So ideally we're working to get someone in that 3, 4, 5 range. Ideally we're getting someone that's, you know, not straining and not having any sort of pains with bowel movements, and things like that. So yes, yeah. It could be their quote unquote normal, but doesn't mean that it is what we would desire.
The reason I ask is because we do have a modified infant Bristol stool. I think it's called infant Bristol stool scale, but it incorporates both consistency and color because for babies, color of poop varies a ton. But for some babies, I just do find they're yellow, seedy is what we kind of call. If you haven't ever seen what a baby poop diaper looks like, go Google it. It's a little bit unique, but for a breastfed baby. So we usually call yellow seedy like normal, but I have worked with babies that their normal doesn't have that consistent. Like it doesn't ever, we never obtain that in there. Mm-hmm. So I didn't know for adults if that translated.
We probably give a little more leniency in the infancy stage, just understanding that it's a transient time period and things will start to solidify and get more towards the standard Bristol stool scale, which we can use in children and adults once we start having kind of normal bowel movements and move away from using diapers and having like actual trips to the toilet. But that does bring up another thing is color is really important to look at too. I mean, it's still important to notice, but you're probably going to see less changes and you're probably going to pay attention to it a little bit less than you do with an infant. But color can also tell us a lot about the health of adult stool as well, and can tell us some red flags also. So some of the colors that we want to just keep an eye on and look out for are red stools. And so that could indicate the presence of blood. A lot of times you'll be able to tell really easily if it's blood within the stool. If you have stool that has bright red blood in it, that usually means you're having some sort of bleeding from kind of the furthest part of your colon. A lot of times it's the rectum or the anus. And so a lot of times that ends up being a hemorrhoid. So bright red blood in the stool is a little less concerning than having black tarry stool, which would basically mean that we think that there is blood coming from higher up in the intestine. Because basically as blood starts to oxidize, it turns like a black color as it interacts with the stool itself. And so when we start to see that black tarry stool, and it's very, it will be very apparently black, if this is happening to you, it probably will be a stark difference to what you would see from your like normal. And so that's where we start to get concerned. So usually the recommendation is if you're having any sort of red stools or black and more tarry stools, go see a GI doc to get that checked out. Usually it's benign. But the reason we say that is because the risk of colon cancer is rising, especially in young adults, adults that are, you know, under the age of 50 are seeing greater incidences. I'm sure we've all seen those headlines. And one big hallmark of colon cancer is a lot of times they bleed. And so that is a good indication of probably should get things checked out. But again, not to be fear-mongery, majority of the time you'll go to the doctor and they'll be like, looks like we have a little hemorrhoid here, especially if you're seeing some of those bright red stools. But never a bad idea to get screened. I mean, I've personally dealt with IBS for years and got a colonoscopy a few years ago just to be like, cancer runs in my family. I want to be on the safe side. I've had issues with my bowel habits for years and just want to make sure that we're good. Because the other reason you would push to get some sort of screening done is when you have that consistent change in your bowel habits. So say you are always a type, you're a perfect unicorn pooper type 4, but all of a sudden now we're dealing with like you're straining to have a bowel movement. You have a type 1, you used to go every day and now you're going every 3 days. That's an indication for we want to go talk to someone, unless we can kind of rule out that it's like, I definitely changed my diet or I definitely did something. But it's always a good idea to talk to someone because some of those changes in bowel habits can be early predictors or early signs of some of those issues as well.
So it sounds like it's similar for infants, and we talked about this a little bit last week, which is kind of probably how we ended up talking about this week. But yeah, the blood and the stool being one, but that kind of leads me to another question, because we have these kind of guidelines for babies, but I've always wondered, is there too long? Well, okay, obviously there's too long to go without pooping, but how long is too long to go without pooping? And you're going to think I'm weird, but last year on Bachelor in Paradise, a girl got extracted. Did you ever see that on social media?
No, I never watched that.
A girl got extracted because she hadn't...
You mean impacted?
No.
Or did she have to get it?
She got extracted from the show. Okay, yeah. Okay. But also, I do think it's because she had to get the poop extracted. And the doctor called it a poop baby. It's like, this is ridiculous. But that leads me to think, at what point should someone be concerned if they haven't pooped? And also, maybe this is getting a little too in the weeds, but also, how does that overlap with, like, I'm traveling. So that's a little different than normal at home changes.
Yeah. So the recommendation or general, like, kind of guidelines for how often you should be going to the bathroom is 3 times a day to every 3 days. And so that's a pretty normal, quote unquote, window. But again, I will highlight, like, you should keep tabs on what is normal from you because it's definitely very different to if you went 3 times a day and all of a sudden you're going every 3 days. That's a big change, but that window is really where we see what's quote unquote normal for most people. Ideally though, we're going at least once a day. So once to twice a day is kind of a good proxy. And so usually what I try to work towards with people is at least going once a day, especially if we're dealing with individuals that have IBS-D, which is the diarrhea. Like, let's get them down from going multiple times a day to like once or twice a day, to if we're dealing with someone that's going only once or twice a week, can we get them closer to that one day, once a day range?
And that's actually really interesting, because for infants, you know, it's kind of crazy how little changes. I mean, you change a ton from the time you're a baby. But for babies, we're looking like anywhere from once a day to three or more poops a day. Mm-hmm. And so I guess it doesn't really change that much. But I do wonder if someone has always, for them, gone every 3 days, you know, like, can that be diet related? Like, so you were saying maybe you try to get them towards, what types of things do you see are helpful for pushing someone in the direction of my normal has been every 3 days and getting them to a more ideal movement?
Yeah. So a lot of times we'll start with just pretty much foundational principles. What does your diet look like? Are you, one thing I check off a lot, especially in women who've been taught to diet for, you know, historical time period, is, are we actually eating enough? That's something that I see kind of often, is that, are we even eating enough to, like, move our bowels once a day? Because if you've had been on, like, a restrictive diet for a period of time, if you're not putting food into your system, you're not going to have anything to come out. And so people can get really frustrated of, like, I really want to go once a day. I feel like I'm eating enough fiber. And maybe they are, but maybe they're not even just eating enough, period. And maybe that just might not be helping support, like, their overall gut health and motility as well. And so the next bit would be, like, if we're eating enough food, is there enough fiber that is a part of that food? And so the general recommendations for fiber for a starting point, it's not perfect for everyone, because some people are going to need more, some people may need less, but the recommendations are 14 grams per 1,000 calories. So most people are going to need anywhere from 25 to 40, up to even like 50, 60 grams, depending on how much you're eating. And there seems to be, like, there's definitely like a high point. I've had people, you know, message me before and be like, can I eat too much fiber? And I'm like, you would probably know. So a lot of times you will probably know if you're eating too much fiber, your body will kind of give you that feedback of depending on the type of fiber you're eating, you could get a little backed up if we're eating a lot of like soluble fibers, things that kind of slow down the GI tract, versus if we're eating a lot of insoluble fiber, things are going to be moving really quickly. So you may be overdoing it if you know, if you're going to the bathroom, you know, 5-6 times a day, you're like, maybe had a little too much fiber that day. And so kind of tangented that a little bit. So fiber is the other thing I look at aside from food, but then things like water, are we drinking enough water? Because things will get really backed up if we don't have enough fluid moving into our system. Movement, have we been really sedentary for a long period of time? Travel, a lot of people get constipated when they travel, and a lot of people go to the other realm and get diarrhea when they travel. So that's pretty normal as well. So kind of looking normal, but we can correct for it. And so kind of looking at all of those things. And then one thing that comes into play, especially when we're dealing with IBS, is stress. Stress is a big trigger for a lot of individuals with IBS. And depending on what their reaction is, IBSD, they, you know, dominate with diarrhea. IBSC, they dominate with constipation. Depending on what your reaction is, you could go one of those ways. So stress is another one that I kind of like cover bases on. So there's even more that you can go into, but that's kind of where we start.
That's interesting. So, I had a train of thought and then it left the station for a second. So you started by saying, like, making sure, oh, here's where my train of thought was going. You started by saying 14 grams for every 1,000 calories. And I just want to do, for those of you that aren't good at math, because I find this in my client population too, which I don't work specifically with people that are having GI issues necessarily, but we all end up seeing a large spectrum, right? And I have to be able to identify that. Math that Jesse did really quickly means you probably shouldn't be eating less than 1,800 calories a day. Okay. So I do, at least in my practice, I find that especially my female clients have a little bit of a warped perspective on what is enough in to make it be enough out. And then I guess I have a question about that. If you have someone who has not maybe been getting enough in, can that impact the ability for your GI tract to consistently stool in the event that they are putting more in?
Yeah. So we see this a lot with eating disorders. And so especially like restrictive eating disorders. So if we are dealing with an individual who has been on a really restrictive diet or really had really low intake for a long period of time, their GI tract will kind of downregulate in motility because you're not giving it the stuff it needs to move. And you're also not giving your body enough nutrients to even support the GI tract from like a cellular health perspective and things like that. So things will start to downregulate outside of just your metabolism itself, trying to go into kind of preservation mode and downregulate. So overall, everything in the body kind of slows down. And so the gut is the same. So things will start to slow down. I always kind of say, like, if you're not using it, you're losing it. So it kind of, our GI tract is a muscle. And if you're not working it, like, you will lose some of that muscular tone and that rhythmic contraction. Our GI tract also loves that consistency, and it has like a routine of having those contractions. And so that's why eating on a regular basis is really important to help kind of facilitate those contractions too, and those natural movement of our GI tract. And so you can lose that for a period of time, which means it can be kind of painful and uncomfortable to get it back up to where it needs to be. Because again, like, it's like a muscle, you can train it. And it can get more used to having those normal, regular bowel movements. But a lot of times there's like a period of time where we have to be like consciously of like, yes, I know I've restricted for a long period of time. I know my GI tract's moving slow. I want it to move faster. I know this is going to be uncomfortable for me for a period of time. And then that's when there's different tools and tricks we can pull out to kind of help support that individual as they're starting to gain more of that motility to help kind of encourage them to have a bowel movement. And so you absolutely can gain it back, but yeah, it will kind of downregulate.
That's really interesting. And now I'm going to throw you a little curveball that we kind of plan in advance, like maybe what we'll talk about, but I just thought of this while you were talking. Does this mean though that one of the potential downsides of fad dieting in an intermittent fasting approach could be irregular bowel habits, because in my head I'm like, well, if it needs regularity, and I know new research is coming out that shows that maybe women need 9 hours of sleep, sometimes if they're on the menstrual cycle, like 10, but I mean, that's still not 18 hours. So is it that quick of an impact, or is it more, you're talking like long-term?
So usually a little more long-term, but I'm going to throw something back at you that is a little bit of kind of a tidbit of information that I think a lot of people forget about, is a lot of times intermittent fasting, you skip breakfast and sometimes lunch, and you just have like a large dinner. What we're missing out on, especially for dealing with somebody that has more of a chronic constipation issue and having more issues of having a bowel movement every day, is we have something called our gastrocolic reflex, which is basically, you probably deal with babies all the time. They eat something, something's going to come out the other end. That tends to be most active in us in the morning. And so that's why if we're dealing with chronic constipation or any sort of constipation, breakfast is really important. Having a good sizable breakfast can really help that, take advantage of your gastrocolic reflex being most active in the morning. That's why most people have a bowel movement in the morning. You know, drink your coffee, you have a bowel movement. It's not always just the coffee. It's sometimes that gastrocolic reflex just reacting to having food or liquid
and
put
into
the system.
And if you're only having one meal, there might, you know, like you might not have the right timing of what your, you know, stool is moving through. But it is true that babies poop while they're breastfeeding. Oh, I mean, so many parents will tell you that as soon as they will have just changed the diaper, because that's usually the baby stirs, they change the diaper, they breastfeed, and then the baby like poops and they're like, okay, great, I just changed your diaper. So that is true too for babies.
Yeah, it maintains into adulthood. And so we usually try to, like, when working with individuals with constipation, take advantage of that gastrocolic reflex and try to, you know, like, let's have a big breakfast. Let's have some warm liquids at breakfast, too. It doesn't have to be coffee with caffeine. It can just be warm liquid, helping to kind of relax the GI tract and get things going and move things along. And so from the other aspect, there's definitely people that have what we would consider an overactive gastrocolic reflex. And so a lot of those people end up with more of the IBS-D or diarrhea. And so that those are the type of people that are like, I eat something and then I'm running to the bathroom like soon later. And it's like every time I eat something, I've got to go to the bathroom and it's kind of liquid and things are moving through my GI tract too quickly and all of that kind of stuff. And so that's where we have to kind of say like, hey, can we try to like, what are some things we can do to maybe try to avoid such a strong gastrocolic reflex? So that could be like, maybe we're having smaller meals throughout the day, and there's different tools that we can do throughout there as well. But yeah, trying to like harness and take advantage of our own biology, understanding and making it work for us.
I was actually going to ask if someone had a strong gastrocolic reflux, does fiber content consistently throughout the day then become more important? Because if you missed a meal with a good amount of fiber, that meal, because obviously we know our gut transit is, it goes in boluses, right? So if they miss the good amount of fiber at a certain meal, could that increase the risk in that situation for activating the strong reflex where they're like, okay, now I'm really running? Or is that off?
It could. Usually, so there's a lot of factors that can go into play here. So we could add in, if we're having someone that's having, like, basically, let's remove the gastrocolic reflex bit, but just say, like, we're having episodes of diarrhea throughout the day. How can we slow this down a little bit? There's definitely things we can add in, like some more of us, we can eat more soluble fibers, or we can take a soluble fiber supplement to try to absorb some of that water, slow things down as it moves throughout the GI tract to kind of avoid as much of that impact as it's kind of moving throughout the day, and just try to kind of slow things down. So, yeah.
That makes sense.
There's definitely things you can do.
And it is similar in infants. One of the challenges we have with infants in general with their GI health is that they're eating a liquid diet. Not to mention that their GI tract is also learning. So yeah, their lower esophageal sphincter is already more floppy, right? And their like intestines already not pre-exercised, right? They were like getting fed through their umbilical cord. So having the liquid diet is, and one of the interventions for that when they are struggling can be to thicken feeds. So that's really interesting. Again, it goes through the whole entire life span, but that actually leads me to another thought that I was having is what is kind of the overlap between IBS versus just having irritation after, like, because I know for myself, there are specific, like, this is probably going to be a TMI, but if I go eat hibachi and have the garlic dress or no, the ginger dressing, I'm going to go to the bathroom later. And that's just something that I know. I wouldn't consider myself someone with IBS, but so what's the big difference between, oh, I ate something that upset my stomach and like a true IBS?
Yeah. So IBS is really tricky to diagnose. It ends up being a diagnosis of like exclusion. So, which basically just means that the doctors are going to have to rule pretty much everything else out before they'll be like, yeah, you have IBS. And they should do that. So if your doctor's not doing that, and if you go to them and you're like, I'm having some weird bowel movements, and they're not asking anything further and just being like, it's probably IBS, probably probe a little bit further because it is a diagnosis of exclusion and they need to exclude other things. Oftentimes in order to get kind of a true diagnosis of IBS, you usually have to have like a colonoscopy, because they'll want to rule out things like celiac disease or an IBD, which is, basically things like ulcerative colitis and Crohn's disease. So like an actual pathology ongoing in the gut, because IBS isn't that. IBS is not really well understood from a research perspective. But it does seem to be kind of a disorder of this gut-brain axis. So our connection between our gut and our brain seems to be dysregulated. The microbiome seems to be involved too. But basically, most people, and there is some research suggesting that there might be a little bit of an inflammatory process ongoing with individuals with IBS. But usually, it doesn't really show up as anything. So they're going to do a colonoscopy. They're not going to see anything. And you'll come back essentially clear, but you're still having kind of the ongoing GI issues. That's when a diagnosis of IBS can be made. And essentially it just means like your gut's finicky and you are usually are going to lean more. We have various versions. Like I've hinted at before, we have diarrhea, we have constipation, we have mixed. And then we have one that's just like, it's all over the place. It's not even like, I wouldn't even consider it, you know, whatever. So that's you. And so that one's kind of our other catch-all, but usually most people fall in and I predominate with diarrhea or I predominate with constipation. And so the difference with that is IBS usually is associated with having that consistency of symptoms. And so it's not just, I eat this one food every single time. I know I have this issue. A lot of people could say with lactose intolerance, a lot of people have that. I eat ice cream. I know I have an issue with that. And that's not really IBS. IBS is not always, can be, but not always responsive to food. So one, like I hinted at before, one of the big triggers of IBS is stress. And so it's not always, I have to remind people that when I work with them, like we can't always demonize food. It's not always the food that's causing these issues. Can we look at some of these other things? Because we do, again, know that IBS is that disorder of that kind of gut-brain regulation. And so there is a big difference of just having like an instance with one food, which then we might say like maybe you're sensitive to that food, or you have an intolerance to that food, and then that's going to cause you to run to the bathroom. But IBS, the real criteria or difference there is just that consistent pain that's going to kind of be ongoing for a period of time. And there's a lot of things that there was a really great session at one of our national conferences a couple of years ago that talked about all of the different IBS mimickers. So things that are that overlap with IBS that are similar in the way they present. And I will say, I do see this a lot working with clients, and it's things like endometriosis a lot of times can present with similar IBS-like conditions. And a lot of times individuals will have IBS and they can have IBS and endo at the same time. Again, that's because with endometriosis, that tissue grows in places it's not supposed to, and the gut's so connected down there with all of those other reproductive organs that a lot of times it can grow within the gut and have those issues there. And then one big thing is pelvic floor issues that actually we see a lot in individuals with IBS and without IBS, and it can kind of overlap and cause some of the same symptoms. And so are you able to basically, is it too tight or is it too loose? Are you able to actually coordinate those muscles to have a bowel movement? Or are we having some issues with kind of keeping things in when they need to be in and we're running to the bathroom?
Yeah. And that definitely overlaps with pregnancy, because not just because they had a baby through the birth canal and so in general they're sore, but also because there can be pressure on certain muscles that in pelvic floor in general can become weaker. There are things you can do to prevent that or reverse it, but pelvic floor generally, that's why people who have had babies say they can't hold their pee. But if we do appropriate pelvic floor strengthening, you can reverse that. So is that similar though for stooling?
Yeah. So a lot of times what we'll see, and it can go like chronic constipation. So having that stool like build up can put some of the pressure on that pelvic floor. So that can over time weaken it. But we can also see constipation caused from having just not being able to like have that contraction, having kind of basically a too tight pelvic floor. So a lot of times we'll encourage people to do you can do different stretches and things to kind of relax that pelvic floor to have a bowel movement. From the constipation perspective, it can kind of go both ways. And from diarrhea, a lot of times if we're going to be associated with the pelvic floor, a lot of times it's on the weaker side and we're having a hard time kind of holding things in. But I feel like just from my personal experience, I see more issues with pelvic floor in individuals that are dealing with kind of constipation. And that's inability to kind of weaken that. And it's usually in women that in individuals that have not had babies yet too. So maybe that pelvic floor is just tight.
Well, but even in postpartum period, it ends up more frequently I see also constipation, even though, and I don't know if that's because of where the pressure, I don't know as much about pelvic floor, but I don't know if where the pressure is, maybe it is not as strong for, you know, bladder control and it's too tight or whatever. But the other thing I was kind of thinking that's interesting is that endometriosis does, though we don't have an exact etiology, does have overlap with hormones. So what is going on? And this is another thing that I think I've even asked you about this, but period poops, you can almost always tell when, like, if you are someone that doesn't use birth control and you do more, like you are cycle tracking sometimes, well, at least for me, again, TMI, but sometimes you can have like, and actually this is not, I know this is not just me, because I have these conversations with my clients. Sometimes you can track kind of where you are in your cycle by how your stooling habits change. What is there a reason for that?
Yeah. Hormones are fun, aren't they? And so throughout our, as most people are probably aware, we have these different changes in our hormone levels and fluctuations over the course of our entire menstrual cycle. So over the course of that month-ish time period. And so where we start to see GI issues start to crop up more is in that luteal phase. So that later portion of the menstrual cycle, when those hormonal levels start to drop and kind of they hit the peak of kind of that ovulation, and then they kind of start to drop. And I'm keeping things very basic and not growing into all of the different hormonal fluctuations. But in general, we start to see those things crop up later in the cycle. And so a lot of times what people will have is they'll start to feel a little more bloated, a little more constipated leading up to their period. And then when their period starts, things will start moving, and then they'll start leading more to having a little bit more loose stools, a little more diarrhea. And that's really due to part of the contraction process that occurs when we start to bleed involves something called prostaglandins, which are not targeted just to our uterus. They're kind of just floating around there, and our gut is very close in proximity to our uterus. And so basically these prostaglandins will cause contraction of the uterus, which is basically that cramping that you're feeling with having usually that first few days of a menstrual cycle. Again, that can cause that cramping feeling and contractions of your GI tract. And so a lot of times people will have those period poops and stools will be a little more loose. And so a lot of times, again, you'll lean more to constipation and feeling a little bit more bloated up into your period. And then once you finally start your period, it's kind of like your body's like releasing everything at once.
How much of a challenge is it when you are, okay, actually I have two questions. One is if you are working with someone who is using a hormonal birth control, mm-hmm. do you still see those same fluctuations, or because they are kind of balancing using the birth control, you don't see those same fluctuations? Do you know?
It depends on probably what hormonal birth control they're using. Yeah. If it's mimicking more of a natural cycle, then you can still see some of those effects. And birth control can just cause GI side effects in and of itself. But it usually, I mean, one of the reasons people go on birth control, aside from preventing like pregnancy, is to like normalize some not so comfy cycles and feelings. And so sometimes when you're on that birth control and maybe you have really bad cramps, sometimes that can resolve some of that really bad like period poop as well. Mm. But usually the cramps are of your worry, and you're like, yeah, the poop is fine.
You know, that kind of though makes me think about circling back, because the overlap here in a lot of these research or evidence base is in women's health. We don't have a ton of evidence, mm-hmm. because at the beginning you said, well, there could be something going on underneath. And we in women's health, we do widely know this, that a lot of young women, you know, teenage years, get put on hormonal birth control in order to help regulate their heavy flow, et cetera. Mm-hmm. But if you dig further, there is a potential other reason why they're cycling irregularly, having heavy flow, one of being endometriosis, which we talked mm-hmm. about overlapping already. So in a population that isn't using hormonal birth control, how difficult is it to, and that is like having issues with GI symptoms, does that complicate things like where they are in their cycle? And it's just, we're going to have less effective nutrition interventions mm-hmm. at this time of the month.
Yeah. So usually when I work with people, we track our cycles, or we're just at least aware of them. We don't need detailed information, but I encourage them to be kind of aware of your cycle. And like, one thing that I was going to bring up too is when a lot of times individuals with IBS, so we have this thing called visceral hypersensitivity, which basically means that the feelings that happen in our guts feel much more severe than just the average person. So we're just way more sensitive to the feelings that are in our guts. So what would feel like normal digestion to one person might feel like pain in someone with IBS. And that's kind of that dysregulation of that pain signaling. And we call that visceral hypersensitivity. I've seen this overlap with ovulation a lot. And so a lot of times individuals with IBS, it's not uncommon for them to feel that ovulation pain more significantly someone else.
I have heard that there are people that can, and I've always been like, that's not a thing for me, but that's super interesting. So it actually is because of signaling that's happening around their abdominal. Yeah.
Yeah. It's the sensitivity to the pain in the abdominal cavity, or viscera, that mm-hmm. area. It's just, you're hypersensitive. And so I do see, and personally speaking from experience with someone with IBS, I probably feel worse when I ovulate than when I have my cycle. Just because the signaling is just that visceral hypersensitivity is much more, I can feel it much more prominently. And so I forget where we were going with that too.
I was asking about how like cycle might overlap with actually figuring out what's triggering like a GI discomfort, if that makes it more difficult.
So what I was saying was before I squirreled, and that just proves how ADHD my brain is right now. But basically I get them to kind of track their cycle, because there's different things that we can use in their like toolkit of like, I know that as I lead up to my period, I get more constipated. So maybe we pull out, you know, and add in this fiber supplement at that period of time to help encourage things. Or I know when I start my period, maybe you get more, like you have a little bit more loose stools. Are there things that we can add in, like the fiber supplements, that can kind of help kind of bind things up? And so there's definitely things we can use in like a toolkit, and it's usually like holistically approached. So are we, can we look at different things like different stress levels and all that kind of stuff too? So not just diet, but exercise, hydration, stress, all of that stuff too. So it's knowing when to pull kind of what trigger and what thing from the toolbox to kind of help support the individual. So yeah, tracking your cycle is really important when you're trying to kind of manage some of those GI side effects.
Yeah. And that just, I feel like, and we're going to end up being broken records on some of these things, but like, I actually really think that's one of the things that would lend itself to having a professional helping you, because it could become really easy to wonder or even become like hyper fixated on, you know, all of those different factors and whether or not, you know, well, I crave sweets my whole life, but I do notice hormonally, like cyclically more, but one, even starting to wonder things like, well, I was craving that and I had more, was that the GI symptom or was that the period poops that came, you know, like starting to get into those weeds can be probably stressful. If you are too hyper-focused on it.
Yeah, that is absolutely, and again, we'll harp on it throughout this podcast, just that it's nice to have that objective viewpoint from the outside who can just say, well, have you thought about this? Or I don't really know if we're dealing with the food issue here, or, you know, because a lot of times we can get super hyper fixated. A lot of times I end up working with someone and they're super hyper fixated on food because it's like, I'm working with a dietitian, it has to be the food. And it's like, have you considered that we're dealing with stress? Have you considered these other things?
Well, and a lot of times, at least with my clients, I see this, that the food ends up being the culprit because that's something they can control. The stress that they're feeling from their job, most people can't just quit their job and like walk away. The stress that they're feeling because they have three kids under the age of five, I mean, you're not giving back your children. You're just like, okay, this is a tough period of life. The stress that you feel because you lose a loved one or whatever that is, those are out of control, out of your control. And then, you know, some other more chronic health conditions that might have a genetic tie or those things are not. So the food ends up being a really easy scapegoat because it is in your control. You make your meals, you put them in your body. So it can sometimes, I feel like, be the default assumption that that's what it is. And, you know, sometimes there's a genetic predisposition for something we can't, there's no amount of medical nutrition therapy that we can do to lower someone's cholesterol if they have an inability to like take in LDL into their liver. There's nothing you can do to change that. So that's just really all interesting. Okay. So thinking a little bit about the more fun side of being a dietitian, we get to like explore in all of the, I don't know, like weird health things that go on. What are your favorite gut health things?
Like items and stuff like that, like items, I use.
Yeah, that you use, like that you would recommend. What are your defaults, your go-tos that you're like, every single client we end up talking about this.
Yeah. So if you don't have a squatty potty, even if you don't have IBS, you probably should get a squatty potty. So squatty potties are great. So if you're unfamiliar, it is basically a stool that you prop your feet up on that sits in front of your toilet and it puts you in a correct anatomical position for you to have a bowel movement. So you're basically squatting. The way we sit on the toilet nowadays kind of closes our like distal portion of our rectum and our anus and kind of puts it in a weird position. And so if we have the squatty potty, which essentially just elevates our feet, it kind of aligns our pelvis a little bit differently to where things should move more smoothly and more of a straight line out. And it is a game changer for a lot of people, especially individuals that are dealing with more of that constipation. It can really help with moving things along. So that's probably my one thing that, like, even if you don't have IBS, get you a squatty potty or prop your feet up on a stool. You know, it just needs to be like 6-ish inches in height. It doesn't have to be super tall. But Google squatty potty. Also, you can see that, Google that anatomical positioning changes that you can't see with a podcast.
I was going to share very funny story. I had no idea in my brain that my husband ever considered this as a thing in his life. But we went to a game night at Jesse and Jared's house one night. And of course, Jesse has a squatty potty. She just shared it's like her favorite thing. But we came home and my husband was like, Jesse has a squatty potty and she does gut health, so I'm sold on it. And ordered a squatty potty for our house. And then the next time that Jesse and Jared were over, Jesse went downstairs and she's like, you guys got a squatty potty. And I was like, that's because Bruce went to the bathroom in your house and felt totally like empowered of, well, if she's got it, then it's got to be legit. So that's we how love, we, ended we love up a, with squatty a squatty potty.
We love a squatty potty. And they make even travel versions too, that you can like, that will like fold up and you can take with you, or you can just get inventive and like prop your feet up on your suitcase or something when you're traveling. If you're not weird about having your suitcase near the toilet, you know, just wipe it down afterwards. One other thing that I find myself recommending a lot and touting a lot is I love, my go-to fiber supplement is psyllium husk. It is, most people recognize it as Metamucil. So Metamucil is the brand name. It has orange flavoring. You can get it in sugared or sugar-free version. Usually I recommend people to get it in the sugar-free version. But the one thing, tricky thing we come in with IBS is sometimes the like flavorings in the sugar-free version can irritate some of those symptoms. But you can get it plain version anyways, but the Metamucil version tastes a little bit better and it's easier to get down. But psyllium husk, is great for if you're dealing with constipation or diarrhea. So it's like a go-to of like, it's a fiber supplement that's going to help with both. Because basically what it does is, this is funny too, because during my master's program, my first interaction with psyllium husk was I had a professor in my like advanced nutrition class. We were talking about fiber and gut health, which is probably where my love started, but he would bring in Metamucil to class and mix it up at the beginning of class in like a pretty concentrated dose. So not a lot of water, large amount of Metamucil. And he would be like, we'll come back to this at the end of class. And then he would essentially come back to the end of class and then go and like pretend to dump it over someone's head and it wouldn't come out because it would form this like solid gel block. And so, so Metamucil essentially does that within your body, or psyllium husk does that within your body. It is a gel forming fiber. It absorbs water and forms a gel. So things are going to move through your GI tract more slowly, and it's going to absorb some of that water along the way, which can help with constipation and diarrhea. From a constipation perspective, it's pulling that water and forming that gel into the intestine. And so it's creating like a mass that's going to kind of your push its way through poop. Your GI tract. Yes.
The number four.
And then from a perspective of diarrhea, a lot of times we're dealing with a little bit of extra water in the GI tract. And so it's going to kind of absorb some of that water and help form some of those, that stool, so that things aren't quite as loose. So love me some psyllium husk. Another one that's also good that kind of has the same effect is sun fiber. Sun fiber has, it's PHGG, partially hydrolyzed guar gum, but sun fiber is like a more brandish name. That one's a good one too, that kind of works for both. But I personally love psyllium husk. So
for all of the people listening that are like me and that are sensitive to the texture, is it as effective to like use a capsule of that, of psyllium husk? I know you're going to have to take more capsules to like equal probably the same amount. Is that as effective?
It ends up being more capsules. I've not seen like research on like the effectiveness, but just in my personal experience of like working with individuals, I do find that people seem to be a little more successful with the powdered form. And just kind of mixing that in with the capsule. The capsule is going to have to break down and release it, and it probably breaks down fine. The one thing I do notice a lot of times, the capsule versions, or even eating like the fiber gummies, the level that's in the standard dose of that is much less than that you would be able to take from just like a powdered supplement. A lot of people end up just taking less of it because the recommendation on that form is less. And so usually for just controlling more and of having a little bit more control, I like the powdered version. The texture is a little bit not great. But usually what I tell people is, water is really important with these fiber supplements. But it does say like to mix it in like 8 ounces of water or something like that. I mix it in like 2 and then I chug it and then I follow it up with a lot of water, just so that I don't have to like sit there and like consciously like have to like drink it down.
Interesting.
As long as you're putting enough water into your system immediately along with it, you're fine. It doesn't have to be kind of mixed in. So usually I take it like shot and then follow it up with a bunch of water.
So similar from I work with kids, and so I have worked with kids that need some extra fiber and they're more picky, and generally they'll eat the gummies. They won't drink the psyllium husk. So it's more of a dosage thing in that situation too.
The gummies aren't ineffective, but a lot of times if someone's taking a gummy and we're not having any benefit and we immediately switch to like an actual like powdered version or even the capsule form, they're going to see much more benefit. The gummies are just dosed much less. And that ends up being with a lot of vitamins and minerals or different supplements. If it's in gummy form, it's usually not the like most bioavailable form or best form. But you kind of pick your battles there. It might be easier to get a kid to take it.
Yeah.
I feel like I was going to say something else. Oh, with psyllium husk too, and fiber in general, it's not just gut health. It can help lower cholesterol and keep cholesterol low. So that is really important too, because essentially what these gel forming fibers do in our GI tract is they will bind to fat and absorb fat and cholesterol through the GI tract. And so it will actually prevent it from being absorbed, but they'll also interact with bile in our GI tract too, and cause us to excrete it. And normally our GI tract, we like to recycle our bile, and our bile will go back into circulation and basically be used again to help us break down fats when we use it again for digestive purposes. But if we're excreting that, our body has to create more bile. And what it does is it pulls cholesterol from our bloodstream to the liver to create new bile so that we then can metabolize fats again and break them down in the GI tract. So fiber is really important, especially those soluble gel-forming fibers can really be really impactful for lowering cholesterol from a nutrition standpoint. So love psyllium for all the reasons.
Knowing this was Dr. Hoffman coming out, because that is Jesse's for sure favorite metabolic food, nutrition, metabolism interaction in the body.
Yeah.
So
I will get so excited when I talk to students about that. And I'm like, and do you know what bile is made from? And they're like, no. And I'm like, it's made from cholesterol. And you know where it has to come from in order for our liver to synthesize new bile? It has to come from your bloodstream.
So gosh. Yeah. Well, I feel like we could talk for multiple more hours about poop.
Yeah.
We'll probably have another episode about poop at some point. But if you have enjoyed this conversation, Jesse has created a slew of poop resources on GroveNutritionCollective.com. There's a couple sprinkled into the freebie, but the paid version has blog posts and handouts and even the Bristol stool, a modified Bristol stool scale that's her own spin on it. You can find it at GroveNutritionCollective.com. We would love to continue the conversation with you there. But until next time, stay responsibly caffeinated and reasonably skeptical of nutrition and health claims you see online.
Bye.
Bye.